WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. That's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening. You are tuned in to Monday Night Talk here at 95.9 WATD. My name is Kevin Tachi, and I'm not only the host, but I'm here to help facilitate the conversation this evening from 6:15 until 8 p.m. Conversation gets started right after traffic, your final traffic check of the evening. The State House report returns with State Senator Susan Moran. Senator Moran, representing the Plymouth Barnstable District. We'll chat with her a little bit about the Senate's fiscal 22 budget, maybe some amendments or some things that she's got in the works. I'm sure you've tuned into many a WATD political forum when the question is asked, I would say most times by managing news editor Christine James, what are you doing to bring home the bacon? What are you doing to bring back funding, local aid to your district? We will check in with the senator about that. We'll also kind of get her take on how life is for her post-COVID and coping, and how her district has been coping as we move forward, hopefully with the pandemic in the rearview mirror for the foreseeable future. Following the senator, we will speak with Carrie Byrne. Carrie from KJB Trending Hospitalities. I've talked with Carrie about so many different things, whether it's politics, football, bar pizza, to local restaurants. And tonight we'll actually focus in on local restaurants. How are these establishments bouncing back now that the mask mandate has been lifted, that you know we're seeing folks are out and about and they're returning to, you know, pre-COVID life. And we'll get his take on that and how these business owners are seeing return of or able to find help when it comes to providing said services. We'll talk with them about that. Hour number two, we will have Adam Bond will be joining us, attorney Adam Bond. And we'll talk a little noise pollution, not necessarily your garden variety noise pollution like the neighbors down the street who are having, you know, a rowdy party until all hours, late hours of the night. No, we're talking about where if there's an issue that is higher than a municipality is able to deal with, and depending on if it's a private entity that is making said noise or if it is something that is overseen by the state. We will have Adam talk about that and give some examples and some takes as to, I believe, one of these might be a case that he's working on or two cases that he's working on. So we'll chat with him about that. Then we'll wrap things up. We will have author Maureen Boyle. She'll be joining us. You may remember her about her. Remember, she was in here to talk not too long ago. I want to say it might have been a year or two ago when she was talking with us about her book, Shallow Graves, where she's got a new book. It's called The Ghost, The Murder of Police Chief Greg Adams and the Hunt for His Killer. We'll talk with her about her new book and get all the details on that in just a couple of moments. But right now, time for us to find out what's happening out on the roadways, being brought to you by Brennan's Smoke Shop, online at brennansmokeshop.com, with locations in Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, New Bedford, Weymouth, and coming soon, Hudson, New Hampshire.
Well, thanks, Kevin. The expressway northbound is crawling from the Braintree split to Freeport Street. Then there's a crash in the breakdown lane at the Mass Pike, and watch for a bumper in the center lane. From there, it's heavy to the Government Center exit in the O'Neill Tunnel. Southbound is inching along from the tunnel down to the on-ramp from Freeport Street. Then you're slow from Bryan Ave to the split. 93 North is jammed from the Braintree split to a crash blocking the left lane at Route 28. Route 3 South is busy from the expressway to Union Street. Route 24 South, that's in good shape from 93 to 495, about 17 minutes there. This report is sponsored by Whole Foods Market. At Whole Foods Market, save on plant-based staples with 25% off all Beyond Meat products through June 8th. While supplies last. Plus, Prime members save an extra 10%. Learn more on the Whole Foods Market app. Traffic on the nines every morning. I'm Lisa DeMilo in the WATD Traffic Center.
Hey, it's Jeffrey from Brennan Smoke Shop. Lots of things to look forward to in summer 2021. Thing one, no more masks. Thing two, bars, dudes. Thing three, socks killing it. Thing four, oh, the warm weather. Thing five, ice cream sundaes. Thing six, the beach. Don't forget, Goma's Mini Bike Massacre, June 26th, Wareham. Oh, and tobacco tax increases. And the best thing to happen in summer 2021, Brennan Smoke Shop in rural, tax-free Hudson, New Hampshire. Brennan Smoke Shop, the best smoke shop in Hudson, New Hampshire. Customers must be 21 years of age or older, and proper ID is required. Goma's Mini Bike Massacre is actually the best thing to happen in summer 2021. But Brennan Smoke Shop, Hudson, New Hampshire is wicked cool, too.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk, WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
And we start off our program, our first segment, of course, with the state senator, Susan Moran. She is our guest representing the Plymouth and Barnstable District. Senator, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Kevin. Happy to be here.
I got to tell you, it's good times are ahead. I couldn't have said the last time you and I spoke. I don't know if I could have confidently said that. How do you feel?
You know, when you have that spring is in the air feeling, I think that's what's really permeating through every encounter. I mean, people have broad smiles on their face, and it's not just because they don't have to wear masks or, you know, and the fact that they're vaccinated. It's just really that optimism, and it's going straight from personal encounters to business to the economy.
Yeah, I mean, how do you feel in a post-COVID world? And you know, being an elected official, there's a lot, you know, ahead of us, especially when we talk financially and knowing that one of the things that we're going to talk about is the upcoming fiscal year, which starts on July 1.
Right. So, you know, I agree with the approach that the Senate president has taken. You know, the governor did, you know, distribute to four communities that had a lack of balance with respect to the federal aid. And when you look at the improvements in the collections that most communities have had that have been greater than the initial projections. So we're doing better with our tax collections than we thought we might be at this point in time. And so we have that source of funds along with the federal funds that are just coming in. And so I think that what we need to do is take a thoughtful approach where we look at areas in need that need an extra boost because they've really been hit in the gut by COVID. And then we really try to save as much as we can for not just so much a rainy day, but really more to look at how the funding is helping us. And if anything lags behind, then maybe put an influx there. So I appreciate the methodical approach that both the Senate and House are taking.
So here we are, budget season right now. You know, your part of the branch of government has had a chance to look at the numbers, and where are things at for the Senate and the Senate budget?
Sure. So right now, there's a conference committee between the Senate and the House that are looking at what each side has put in to the budget and to really try to hammer out any differences. And then it'll move back to the governor and see what the governor's thoughts are there. So we're moving pretty quickly, but there's still a couple of hurdles to get through.
You know, I probably maybe the positive thing, if we're talking about this, I want to say the last couple of years, usually the conference committee, usually they don't convene till like later in June. This, I feel this is really positive. This is good that it's being done right now. And yeah, you know what? They may continue their work and their discussions and debate into July. But it's a lot earlier than it has been over the past couple of years, especially, you know, because we had a pandemic we were dealing with a year ago.
And I think that's can be attributed to the really good relationship between the Senate president and the House leader. Brett Mariano has just been offering so much cooperation between both sides of the legislature. So that's what we all need to be doing from our local communities to the national basis, looking at working together to help the most people out of this pandemic and back to business.
As a senator, you have an opportunity to file amendments and seek things for your district. Christine James fondly calls it during debates, bringing home the bacon, ways to be able to help, whether it's local aid or things that are going to fortify a certain part of the community. What are some of the things that you've been able to either put forth or have discussions with your colleagues?
So, you know, I'm going to start with something that's sort of emblematic. I spoke with a number of students at the Silver Lake School in Kingston, and despite, you know, being youngsters and really looking at how to adapt to wearing masks, maybe, you know, online learning, not really being with their friends, their civics class has come out with a program to upgrade the outside of the school building so that they can have another learning center, and that'll be used past, you know, COVID. So that's $10,000. I'm hoping to seed their project. And it's, while it's not the biggest amount of money, I think that's something that is, it shows the resilience and the energy of these young kids that we all should take a page from. On the bigger side, one of the economic development projects that we're hoping to get going, along with my partners in the legislature, Rep. Murituri, Lenatra, Xaros, where I have put in $150,000 to do a study to look for a regional convention center. And in the Plymouth area, it's something that has been needed for a long time. Lee Filsom is working on it. And again, we need to make modest investments to really jumpstart our economy and really get our funds flowing back locally. So that investment I expect to be returned incredibly to the business community. A couple of other things, $100,000 to help police who have to deal with a lot of mental health issues while they're dealing with their public safety issues. So, you know, we talked when we did the police legislation about really putting additional funds in so that police could really focus on what their training is best at, and so they could partner with mental health professionals. $150,000 in veterans food security, and $500,000 into early education. I've got a very important bill, which is for universal child care, And that's looking forward to get young families back to work so that they can be assisted in their childcare costs from children ages zero all the way up. If there are special needs up to age 15, that'll include after school care. And the thought there is, of course, economic development, but in particular, women who have had to, in terms of the numbers, many more women have stayed home, done the hybrid schooling. They've oftentimes had to give up their jobs. And this will be help for them to not only get back to work, but get back to the same place they were in their careers. So those are just a couple of examples.
You mentioned that the universal child care, is that something just district specific, or are you hoping to seed something that is going to be more spread across the Commonwealth?
You're absolutely right. That is going to affect the entire Commonwealth. I've been listening to the childcare businesses in our district. The employers who own the businesses want to have resources so that they can allow their workers to get higher professional degrees. The workers need to be paid more up to the level of starting kindergarten teachers is what we're shooting for over a 5-year period. And right now, when you look at overall the state, the cost of childcare is about the same for a child as it is for a monthly mortgage or rent. A year at UMass Amherst over the year. These are just unsustainable costs for young families. And, you know, when you look at, I have $50,000 for elder care. What we have right now are families trying to help each other, and we're, you know, all giving up time with at our jobs to try to help the younger members in the family with their kids. The intergenerational benefit, if the universal child care bill moves forward, which I have with Senator Lewis, will really be an incredible shot in the arm to our economy generally.
And if you're just tuning in to this segment, we are speaking with State Senator Susan Morin. She is our guest, of course, the senator representing the Plymouth and Barnstable District. You know, not too long ago, I want to say it was like 2 weeks ago, I had Peter Brown on, who, as we know, he is he's one of those community guys who he loves what he does. He's a business owner, Tiny and Sons Glass. But we were talking with him about being a business owner and what it's like post-COVID. Are you hearing from a lot of businesses in regards to seeking any assistance from the state when it comes to, I don't know, being able to find employees? Because that's the one thing that I'm hearing more and more is that there's plenty of work. There's just not a lot of bodies to fill those positions.
I am, and I've been on a number of forums that I've initiated with the business community to hear directly the specific concerns. With respect to employees, I also met with the Department of Unemployment Commissioner directly and brought those concerns that had been raised by Peter and others right to her. And a couple of interesting points. We, of course, for help for the businesses, we have the there's been an unemployment tax that is just astronomical that we jumped on and have sort of redone, put some assistance in so that businesses are not going to be hit with that big bill, number one. Number two, we talked to the commissioner about new programs where there are hybrid programs that if as an employee you want to go back to work but you can't because of childcare or other reasons really go back full time, and you'd still with this option be able to keep some unemployment while you're transitioning back to work. So there are those kinds of things that I'm inviting everyone who's listening to contact my office And my constituent services director, Monica Mullen, will forward to you the resources that are becoming available very soon or as we speak, and to be sure that people realize that there are choices. It's not all or none. With respect to the individuals who are working with small businesses, we're just trying to get the word out. Rep Lenatra and Cutler and I did a job fair recently to try to have folks, you know, tell their friends about available jobs. We're working a multidimensional approach to try to not only bring new employees to the community, help employees who can do part-time and ease them back into the workforce as we come out of this pandemic, and to also give new resources to employers for their businesses, and just to really tell people in general, the entire district, for the patrons, you know, we're all doing the best we can. It's a transition period. We all want to serve them as well as we can, and a little patience is certainly appreciated.
But when you and I, prior to our segment, were talking about mapping out our conversation and some of the talking points that you and I can kind of go back and forth about, one of them I think you had mentioned in regards to the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station and doing something regarding to shifting burden. Am I correct?
You're absolutely right. So Holtec has really been on my radar, and just looking at what they're doing in decommissioning, they've had a couple of issues that have come up. And one of the things that I want to do is be sure that the bill for the decommissioning is properly shifted away from Plymouth. And that's one of the things that we'll be continuing to push for, along with watching all of the safety issues and being sure it's done properly.
Is there still concern, are local officials still concerned about if this is, you know, how the process is going, and they're going to keep an eye on it until they're sure that it's been done properly?
Well, you know, there are safety measures set up and there are watchdogs involved. But we want to be sure that the public is aware as well, and that the public knows that if there's a concern, you can contact us at my Senate office, and we'll be working with the town manager of Plymouth, along with the Holtec representatives, to be sure that they know that safety is the most important job that we all have.
So a couple of fun posts as we're getting ready to wrap up here with you, Senator. A couple of fun, quick hit questions here. Here we are in a post-COVID world. What's the one activity or set of activities that you've either had a chance to do since we were all quarantined because of COVID, or that you're looking forward to doing now that we're kind of a little freer?
Well, the best thing that I've done is attended Chief Gutierrez's retirement at East Bay. Senator Murray was there, Senator DiMacedo, and those committed, heroic, on-the-line officers were just talking about their experiences. And the amazing thing, in addition to my respect for all of them, was it was about love for a community, for the brotherhood. So that's one thing I got to do. One thing I'm hoping to do is get on the bike path and start getting some exercise. This Zooming is, hopefully a little less Zooming, a little more biking.
So if you were to pick, again, I'm sure you love every part of your district, but a couple of parts of your district that you love stopping by and visiting.
You know, when I was in Plymouth recently, I just had a minute to really look at the seascape. That is, we are so lucky. Five out of my six communities are ocean facing. That was the most incredible to see. The other thing I would see, you know, from Kingston to Bourne, Sandwich, Falmouth, Pembroke, the graduates. The graduates this weekend were, you know, so resilient, and the families, and being able to see the smiles since we're not all masked up now, it really warmed my heart that these folks have the camaraderie. They will always, you know, they will always have that in common, that they were able to push past all of the challenges during COVID and be successful. So those are the most important things.
Senator, you're somebody who cares deeply about your district. If folks want to reach out to you, what's the best way for them to contact your office or you?
Monica Mullen is available for constituent services. We are available at Cordage Park on the Plymouth side. We have a Falmouth office across from West Falmouth Market, as well as the State House. So whether you leave a phone message or an email, we'll be happy to get back with you and follow up as quick as we can.
Senator, thank you again for your time, and hopefully you can enjoy this fantastic weather that we're finally having.
Thanks so much. You as well. Thanks, Kevin. Enjoyed it.
Got it. All right. That wraps up our first segment here with the State Senator Susan Moran. We'll step aside, and I promise in just a couple of moments, more Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD.
Tiny of Tiny Sons Glass. If you're driving along right now and you've got an angry little ding in your windshield.
Ouch!
But good news, we can fix that ding. We'll fix that ding before it spreads. Drive on over to Tiny and Sons, Route 53 Pembroke. We will fix that ding. Your insurance company will pay.
And that's why I sing, give me that ding.
So give me that ding. Tiny and Sons Glass will fix that ding. Insurance company will pay.
That's right.
My dad did a great job. 1-888-64-TINYS. Just call. Give me that ding.
That's nice. Plymouth 400 Inc. continues their mission of education and commemoration of the 400th anniversary of Plymouth's founding with a new television series called Plymouth 400 Conversations. The program will focus on authors, filmmakers, artists, and poets who discuss how the 400th anniversary commemoration influenced their work. Each episode premieres Thursday nights at 7:30 on PAC-TV, but available online for everyone to see the following day. Despite the pandemic, the 400th anniversary commemoration continues into 2021 with great virtual programming now, including this fascinating new virtual series, and live events later in the year. See what Plymouth 400 Inc. has scheduled. Shop for Plymouth 400 anniversary merchandise to share with friends and family, and catch the most recent episode of Plymouth 400 Conversations. Visit Plymouth400Inc.org.
Night Talk continues all week long. Go to 95.9WATD.com/Monday Night Talk and keep in touch on Facebook and Twitter. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Right, and we return here to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9WATD. I can't believe it's already the first show of June. It's like I don't know where the time has gone. And here we are. We're starting to live in a post-COVID world. Joining me, a good friend, we've talked about so many different things over the years on the radio. I fondly know him as the Potentate of Pigskin, but he actually is more so a guy when it comes to food and spirits and what's going on in and around not only the South Shore, but he has expanded now. He's a New York, he's in a New York kind of mindset, but he's still here in and around the South Shore. Kerry J. Byrne is our guest. I thought to have Kerry on, knowing that we talked to him a few times, because he was so outraged that, you know, the shutdown of businesses and the effect that it had on so many great restaurants and eateries, he was outraged. And I wanted to give him an opportunity to talk to my audience and say, hey, listen, now that life is back to normal, you need to start getting out and check out some of these places. Terry, what's up?
Hey, man. How you doing, Kevin? Always a pleasure to be with you. And, yeah, I'm glad things are seem to be improving. But, you know, you mentioned something back to normal. I just took the train back to Boston on Tuesday. And I get out of South Station, 2:30 in a beautiful Tuesday afternoon. I got a picture of it. Not a person on the streets in the middle of downtown Boston, the financial district, the corner of South Street and Summer Street. Right across from the Federal Reserve Bank, South Station. You know exactly what I'm talking about. Nobody out. As of Saturday, Boston, Massachusetts was 100% quote reopened.
Yeah,
and it was great to see the Bruins game packed the other night, right? With people enjoying life and living life. But people still aren't out, Kevin. In a lot of places, downtown Boston is dead. The devastation. The needless human devastation and waste and economic destruction brought about by our leaders is completely unacceptable. I mean, they instilled this fear in people far beyond the scope of the actual threat. They made people afraid to leave their homes. People were literally afraid to leave their homes. They thought they were going to get some, thing and drop dead in the streets, which, of course, people got sick, people died, unfortunately, which is terrible, but that, people always get sick, it's the level of fear was not consistent with the actual threat, not by any stretch of the imagination. Fear stoked by our politicians, fear stoked by our media, to the point now, Massachusetts is 100% open, and the streets of Boston are still dead empty.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable. It's a tragedy. It's a tragedy far beyond the scope of any threat caused by this virus.
But do you feel that it's going to be a slow process for folks to start feeling comfortable again and trusting?
It apparently it is, and that's the tragedy. People shouldn't have been afraid to go out from day one. It never should have been afraid to go out. That was completely unnecessary. Let me cite one statistical example about the difference between the media and political fear-mongering and the actual threat. All the past year, we heard about red zone, 250 Massachusetts towns are in the red zone. Oh, my God, we're in the red zone. The number of towns in the red zone have gone up. The number's gone down. Do you know what the red zone was? The frightful COVID red zone was in Massachusetts?
No.
I think in all states. Was one case per 10,000 people, Kevin. Not one person in the hospital. Not one person dead. God rest their soul. One case for every 10,000 people in your community was in the red zone. So people didn't look at the numbers. They didn't look at the fine print. They looked at the headline. Oh, we're in the red zone. We're in the red zone. Oh, my God. Marshfield's in the red zone. Quincy's in the red zone. Brockton's in the red zone. And people were afraid to go out. You know the percentage of people with any – how many people have herpes right now? You know what I mean? I mean, and that's obviously transmissible through, certain activities, right? And people don't think twice about it. Far more prevalent than this ever was. But that was the red zone, one case for 10,000 people. And that barely a threat caused people to be afraid still to live their lives. And now that we're fully reopened, some people are still afraid to go live normal lives. Businesses are afraid to go back to work. People are afraid to ride the train. People are afraid to do this. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. The actual threat never, ever came close to matching the fear instilled in people's hearts. And that's a fact. That's a statistical fact. And I can cite numbers, chapter and verse all day long on that. It's terrible what happened to some people, but, that's still the fact that I may get sick and die of something terrible. There's no reason for Kevin Tocci to stop living his life.
Right.
And the destruction, 2 years of no school, kids only have 12 years of school. That's one out of six. What's that work out? What's that, 17% of your school life destroyed on something? By the way, more kids died of pneumonia over the past. This is actual CDC data. More children died of pneumonia over the past year of COVID than died of COVID. And people always get pneumonia. People never don't think twice about it. More children died of pneumonia than died of COVID, age 18 and under. And yet people were still afraid to send their kids to school. It's insane. It's not rational. Irrational nightmare this was. And as I saw coming out of the train at South Station on Tuesday last week, they're, you know, it's people are still afraid to go out, and it's sad. I mean, the destruction is going to be with us for quite some time.
Can I ask you somewhat of a rhetorical question?
Yep.
I don't know if there is a real answer to this. Before we kind of, you know, start teasing folks and telling folks where they could go and get some good food and some good entertainment, do you feel that this was more of a political and propaganda type of stunt because of the ongoing optics when it came to elections last fall?
Well, clearly politics played a huge role in it, right? I mean, we know that for a fact. Here's what happened. We've seen over the last week or so all this information come out that Fauci, this is in his own emails now, it's that he suspected that this may be man-made. It may have been some sort of bioterror threat from China. That possibility exists. I'm not saying it was true, but that possibility exists. Our leaders at the highest levels knew that. The one guy who said it, they drummed out of office. They made it sound like an unscientific wacko. It turns out that guy was right all along. That our leaders suspected there was some sort of man-made threat caused by China. This is now known. This is now public information. It's all over the news now that it's convenient politically. Obviously the political problem. What I think is all the leaders, because the fear from the panic, let's call it what it was, the panic from Marty Walsh, the panic from Charlie Baker, the panic from governors all over the nation, the panic from so-called medical experts who you know, obviously you have every reason to question their judgment now. The panic these people caused was disturbing. It never added up. Like, wait a minute, there's only so many people getting sick. Like here where I live in Manhattan, still to this day, less than 7% of the entire population of Manhattan, the most densely populated corner of the country, has had COVID. Over a year, less than 7%. It's like insane. So anyway, there was some sort of panic caused. And I think these leaders suspected, they were told by whatever authorities, medical authorities at the highest levels, hey, this may be some sort of virus caused by China. This may be a bioterror act. We don't know what's going to happen. Let's take all precautions. They had to suspect something because the reaction was so over the top. This has never happened before in human history. Let's shut down everything. Let's close down schools. Let's not let people go outside. It's never happened before. And the precedent sense is awful, but they had to be fearful of something greater than just an ordinary virus. They had to be. And now it's coming out that even this Dr. Fauci suspected that there might be some sort of man-made element behind it. Now it starts to add up, right? Oh, you know, they didn't know. They were frightened that this might be some sort of terror threat, and that's why they reacted the way they did, which made sense from the beginning, but they never said it. And they did. It's not like they were trying to save people from being frightened. They frightened the crap out of people as it was. So how this was handled will go down in history as the worst man-made public health disaster in history. I'm talking about the reaction of leaders around the world to a virus. A very low fatality, low impact virus. You look at smallpox, which we battled throughout human history. The American Revolution was fought in the midst of a 7-year smallpox outbreak. Smallpox had a 30% fatality rate, Kevin. We fought the American Revolution during the middle of it. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams themselves were inoculated by smallpox by sticking the virus in their arm. And they suffered badly. They almost died, all of them. George Washington had smallpox as a child and was lucky to survive. George Washington was covered in smallpox scars the rest of his life. They left horrible scars on the survivors. That was a 30% fatality rate. This was 0.01 fatality. I mean, no one wants anyone to die, but no one wants anyone to have their lives turned upside down because of a perfectly normal act of a virus floating through the air. We're all filled with viruses. We're all filled with potentially deadly viruses. So anyway, the reaction never made sense unless it was something they knew that we didn't. And now it turns out there was something they knew that we didn't, and that comes straight from Dr. Fauci himself, that he suspected this was a man-made threat from China.
And we're speaking with the Kerry J. Byrne. He is so many different things: entrepreneur, journalist, editor, communicator, traveler, brand builder, marketer.
Aspiring hair model, Kevin.
Yes, you are. I see you have some exceptional amount of product in your hair today.
Very, very all natural, Kevin.
KJB Trending Hospitalities. website, KerryByrne.com. And Kerry, what are some of Kerry's takes? If folks are looking to get out this week to grab some great eats, what would you recommend at this particular point?
Grab some what, Kevin? I'm sorry?
Some great eats.
Some great eats. Well, as you know, being a loyal South Shore guy, you're a Brockton native, if I remember correctly, right?
I am, yes.
So I'm from Quincy, so these are the two of the spiritual homes of South Shore Bar Pizza, Kevin.
Yum, yum.
Are you a big bar pizza fan? I know you have some friends in the business.
I am. Yeah. I am a bar pizza fan, and I grew up on bar pizza, you know? Well, the best blue-collar meal you can find.
Absolutely. Well, that's one of the great things. So on the eve of the pandemic last year, to help mom and pop restaurants, I started something called the South Shore Bar Pizza Social Club on Facebook, which has grown into a culinary phenomenon. We call it America's Greatest Restaurant Success Story of the COVID Era, the South Shore Bar Pizza Social Club on Facebook. Now, 33,000 members strong, Kevin, all devoted to a passion for a South Shore bar pizza that you can only get in the dive bars and pubs and taverns and working class watering holes south of Boston. There's dozens of these places. So I've been highly supportive. This group, the South Shore Bar Pizza Social Club, has helped support all these local mom and pop businesses and all the towns in your listenership are big South Shore bar pizza joints. I don't want to name every South Shore town, but you know, from anyone who can hear the station is in South Shore bar pizza country, and these places have been doing great. I'm glad to say that this group, this club, that I started on the eve of the pandemic, it was late last February. I was worried about the future of these restaurants, and the club took off. Not one South Shore bar pizza joint, not one of the, I don't even know the exact number, 60 odd, 70 odd joints south of Boston that make South Shore bar pizza, not one closed. Every single South Shore bar pizza joint survived COVID, Kevin. Think about that. In an era which devastated maybe half of the restaurants in America, every South Shore bar pizza joint survived. They were able to sell takeout. They're all mom and pop joints. Local residents, your listeners, rallied around these places, went to support them, kept them going. Not only did they survive, they've thrived. Many are doing better than ever. So glad to be a part amid the carnage, the unnecessary carnage, as we just discussed. I was able in some small way to help support my neighborhood restaurants, to help support my local communities, and very proud of what it's become. And so get out to your local South Shore bar pizza joint, Kevin. There's so many of these, I trace the history of them. They began allegedly in Brockton at Cape Cod Cafe. And the core of South Shore bar pizza is from Brockton to Quincy. And years ago, there were trolley routes that connected Brockton to Quincy. And I know this, Kevin, because when I coached football at Quincy High, the old timers would tell me they take the trolley to the Quincy-Brockton game down in Brockton. How cool is that? All the kids would hop outside Quincy High School would hop on the train in Quincy Center, hop on the trolley, and show up and, you know, down Route 37 or whatever route it took, show up at Brockton High School and watch the football game. That'd be a lot of fun, right? And so anyway, I traced all the trolley corridors. So South Shore Bar Pizza popped up along all those routes. And today it's Route 37, it's Route 18, it's Route 28, right? That's the heart of South Shore Bar Pizza country. And so get out and support these places, see what it's all about. But it's truly a phenomenon. And it's our unique contribution to regional American culinary culture here south of Boston. So really proud to have helped support it during the pandemic.
So I would ask you, just as we get ready to wrap up here in a couple of moments here, how about some of the upscale establishments, whether they're in Quincy or Hanover or anywhere on the South Shore of the Boston area, anywhere that you want to kind of give Kerry's pick of the day?
So let me tell you, the newest restaurant in Massachusetts, the first restaurant I believe to open and 100% open in Massachusetts, Grill 151 in Weymouth, Route 151 Main Street in Weymouth, right off of Route 3, super convenient. Longtime Weymouth residents, I remember it as a Hearth and Kettle building, been completely gutted, completely renovated top to bottom. Owner Chris DeMambro owned Main Street Grill in Weymouth for many years, a very successful, beloved local eatery. Now, a lot bigger, a lot more upscale. Main Street Grill 151 at 151 Main Street in Weymouth is big and beautiful, 250 seats. Chef Tom Borger is cooked all over Europe, a veteran of many of Boston's most beloved restaurants. A lot of great steaks, great local seafood, beautiful space, beautiful cocktails. I was just there yesterday checking it out. So brand new Grill 151 in Weymouth. Check that out. The most successful restaurant to open during COVID in all of New England is here on the South Shore. Elbron 53 on Route 53 in Hanover.
Yep.
Big and beautiful. Elbron Quincy is a kind of a fine dining landmark on the South Shore. Leo Caker, everyone loves Leo Caker, a great immigrant success story. Elbron 53 has been a phenomenal. Kevin, if you haven't been, I'm going to take you next time I'm back in Boston. You have to see it. It's beautiful. It's been very successful. They distanced everything out. They followed all the guidelines, but people couldn't wait to get in there. It was packed by social distance standards all throughout COVID. It's packed now. People love it. And then, now that you want to eat outside, check out Victory Point in Marina Bay, Kevin.
Ooh.
Drinking on the water. The Frattaroli family, the first family of the North End. These people run much of the North End, Donato Frattaroli and Donato Frattaroli Jr. They're the founders of the Taste of the North End, one of the most successful charity events in America, restaurant events in America. Victory Point in Marina Bay. Sit out there in the water, beautiful Marina Bay. Check that out. They also have Boardwalk Pizza, some of the best pizza in the region. And Donato's Gelato, if you just want a scoop of ice cream, some gelato to walk along the boardwalk. So those are some of my go-to spots in addition to social bar pizza.
And as we close out this segment, I'm going to give you Tachi's pick for brunch.
All right, yeah, absolutely.
The patio at McGuigan's in downtown Whitman, serving up the best Bloody Mary you could find and brunch served in a restaurant that actually, it's the perfect time of year with the windows open.
Yeah.
It's almost like you're eating outside, but you're not. It's fantastic.
I've been there because of you, and I think I've met the owner through you, right? Right. Right in downtown Whitman, right?
That's correct. That's right. Richie
and,
Rose.
Great spot. I've enjoyed it. On your recommendation, Kevin. But I'm taking you out next time I'm back in town.
Can't wait. There he is. Kerry J. Byrne. Check out the website. Check out some of the things that he's working on. He's a man who wears many hats. KerryByrne.com, BYRNE is the website. Kerry, thank you again for your time, as always.
All right, Kevin, thank you very much.
All right, we're going to step aside. That concludes the first hour of Monday Night Talk. And when we come back, hour number two, attorney Adam Bond will be our guest. You're tuned into 95.9 WATD.
WATD FM Marshfield, WBMS Brockton. This is the South Shore's radio station, 95.9 FM WATD. Streaming online at 95.9WATD.com. And with your smart speaker, just by saying play WATD.
Here's the dirt on dust. It may seem fine, but it's actually made of dead skin cells and dust mite droppings. That's where Swiffer Heavy Duty Dusters come in, with thousands of specially coated fibers to trap and lock dust in one swipe. Dust can't hide on ceiling fans and bookshelves anymore. When you're done, just remove the disposable cloth and voila! That dust is gone for good. Now that you know the dirt, say goodbye to the dust. Swiffer Heavy Duty Dusters. Stop cleaning. Start Swiffering.
At Bowles Builders, demand is through the roof. To keep up, his business needs a stronger foundation.
Cut the saw, right? Just one sec. Bowles Builders, this is Bow. This weekend? Yeah, we can do it.
Indeed can help him hire the people he needs.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do. When you sponsor a job, you immediately get your short list of quality candidates whose resumes on Indeed match your job criteria. Visit Indeed.com/credit and get $75 towards your first sponsored job. Terms and conditions apply.
The People's Truth, a show dedicated to bringing communities together and keeping the truth alive. Join your host, me, Benny Rabbi, as we talk with businesses, organizations, and people around New England and the world in search of the People's Truth. Join us tonight at 9 p.m. on 95.9 WATD.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
We return for the second hour of Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. Joining me is a gentleman. He has been on this radio program numerous times. He's had his own radio program. He currently now has his own podcast called Legal Grounds, and it's a show that he does a couple of times a month that is being seen on Facebook. It's Facebook Live and also shown on local cable. We have Mr. Adam Bond, attorney at law, joining us. Sir, how are you?
Pretty good, thank you. Pretty good. How are you doing, Kevin?
I'm good. You know, you and I talked about doing a segment such as this. Knowing that we're coming into the warmer months of the year, the summer months, I wanted to have a conversation. You know, what do you do if you have a noisy neighbor? But you, as you always do, you always look at a wider spectrum. And you're like, well, you know, I'm currently working on a couple of different cases that are a lot greater than just the noisy neighbor, the party hound who lives down the street. We're talking on not only a state level, but also not just something that just happens for a couple of hours, but this is like a long-term thing. So I thought we could
One of the interesting things that you raise, though, is you talk about the summer months when people are sort of letting loose and making noise, and it's neighbors. The fascinating thing is that the noise levels are worse in the winter because of the fact that you don't have the trees and the leaves and all those things creating the buffer for the noise. And that's one of the interesting factors that you see when you start dealing with, I mean, you have a bunch of different types of neighbors. You've got your individual neighbor, the Yahoo, who has a lot of barbecues. That's going to probably be local noise ordinances based on decibel levels, maximum decibel levels that you can reach, or somebody will come by and charge them with a disorderly. If it's in the summer and it's a barbecue, it will probably be a drunk and disorderly, most likely. But putting that aside, those are the slings and arrows we have to deal with, people that aren't decent or act in an ignorant way as your neighbors, and they don't invite you. But the ones that I'm dealing with are more either industrial. You know, you live in a neighborhood. It's in, you know, there's an industrial operation down the street that changes its protocol and gets a new machine, which is 10 times as noisy as the other machines. Or you've got a state agency beginning to engage in building something over a long period of time, since the state never builds anything in short periods of time. They take a while to build it, and it's noisy. What do you do? Those are the noises that sort of keep me up at night, no pun intended, because they run on endlessly. And there are actually agencies and laws and local ordinances and air pollution control commissions that can be set up in districts to control that.
I would think so. Looking at just your run-of-the-mill issue with a noisy neighbor, I would think that most communities have some kind of a bylaw, and there's usually some kind of way for you to, I mean, other than calling the police, I would think that there's some other ways of policing it if you have somebody who is a repeat offender, as opposed to, on a larger scale, dealing with the state and long-term noise.
Yeah, well, I mean, in terms of a noisy neighbor, the problem you have is when you start getting into enforcing that yourself, you know, you go over to the noisy neighbor and you show them the bylaw. You tell them you're not supposed to make that kind of noise after 10 o'clock. You generally get met with, get off my effing property. And you have to call the police anyway. So my recommendation to people is that you call the police and let them get annoyed with the noisy neighbor. After you've tried, you know, go over there, try, say, please, you know, have some consideration, at which point they will have none. And you will then call the police that will possibly have no consideration for the noisemakers, depending on how they decide to act. And hopefully the noise will stop. But that's, you know, that's neighbor politics more than what, you know, I told you I was dealing with Holbrook. I was dealing with Middleborough being ongoing. I mean, if you want to talk about something that's been going for years and years, and, you know, first it's CSX, who just will not negotiate with anybody, and they do what they want the way they want. They idle their trains claiming in the winter they have to do it to keep their engines warm so they don't break down and freeze. And in the summer, they have no excuse for it. They just do it. You know, putting diesel particulate matter into people's lungs who live right next to it. And you say, oh, well, you know, you chose to live next to a train. Oh, I understand that, but the train has to follow rules that apparently the state, who owns the tracks and has the right to enforce, refuses to enforce. These are the issues. It's not that, you know, it's not that I moved in next to a dump knowing I moved in next to the dump and I'm complaining about the smell. If I moved in knowing I was moving in next to a dump and there are laws that restrict the level of aroma that can come from the dump and they exceed it, I have a perfectly good right to complain. And there are laws out there which, you know, everybody says, oh, well, the railroads can do what they want because the area is preempted. It's not. Everybody keeps saying that. In Vermont and Massachusetts, it's not, because when, just bringing you back a little bit, the Clean Air Act, you remember that?
Do.
And under the Clean Air Act, which I think was the 70s, maybe it was the 70s, basically states were allowed to come up with their own air pollution control rules and guidelines, laws. And they'd be reviewed by the EPA. And if they were reviewed by the EPA and okayed, then they would be adopted and federalized. The trains have to listen to federal law. So our air pollution control laws in Massachusetts, which specifically say they apply to the Commonwealth itself, says it right in the law, apply to things like trains and apply to things like state agencies, which actually under the legal framework are required to follow their own these particular rules with regard to air pollution. Air pollution is defined as including excessive noise. So the issue you have is, you know, people building South Coast Rail in Middleborough that are just going nuts, and they're going through the night and they're going through the weekends, and they're, you know, 7, 12, 15 hour days of banging and knocking in excess of what the Mass DEP has set as regulations on excessive noise becomes an issue. And the problem is Mass DEP knows it, but they won't buck the system and tell Mass DOT to do something about it. And the federal EPA knows about it. They've been at the meetings and they refuse to do anything about it. They're like, oh, well, we can't. Of course you can. It's just you do it in rich neighborhoods. You don't do it in poor neighborhoods like Middleborough. When they had issues like that in Boston with the trains in Boston, EPA stepped in and forced them into a settlement on making the trains quieter. They actually created a list of which trains needed to be modified, which trains didn't, all that stuff. But apparently in Middleborough, where you've got a household income of $59,000 a year and you're a red dot in the middle of a blue state, apparently none of that matters. I mean, Gene Fox, who's at the DOT, turned around and said, oh, our noise mitigation department's looking at this. I'm glad they're looking at it. Looking at something doesn't tell you what it sounds like.
Right.
Maybe you need to listen. You know, get the poop out from between your ears. But the other one that drives me nuts is our state representatives, who are in favor of the train, won't do anything. And they claim they can't do anything, and that's probably true because they're Republicans in a Democrat legislature. So anyway, that's the politics of it. But well, back to the neighbors.
Well, how did you, and again, we're speaking with Adam Bond, attorney at law, talking about noise pollution, noise control. We're talking about it on a little bit of a grander scale, not necessarily your run-of-the-mill, down-the-street, noisy neighbor who might need a little bit of
prodding?
Yeah, or at least enforcement, whether it's from local police or the local municipality. But we're talking about where you have this taking place in a municipality. There's no recourse on the local level because it's more so something that you have to deal with on the state level or go to the federal government. How did you come into being involved in this particular case, and where is it at now?
Well, actually, Middleborough. I've got to correct you on something.
Of course you do.
The Middleborough Board of Health has enforcement authority under the EPA rule, and the Middleborough Board of Health has actually gone out there. They've taken sound measurements. They've issued orders to the state to cease and desist until they meet the noise ordinances, and the state has simply ignored it.
Okay, so then in fact, I am correct that the local government has bylaws and has measures in place, but they're not necessarily going to be they're not going to be something that's going to be adhered to by the state because it's coming from a local entity, correct?
The local entity doesn't have a bylaw, a noise bylaw in place. Under the federal bylaw, under the federal regulation, the local selectmen and board of health and the police have the right to enforce. The problem is if there's somebody bigger and badder than you are out there, right, they're not going to care. And apparently, you know, Gene Fox and the DOT don't give a rat's behind about whether or not our health department sends them a letter that says stop doing what you're doing until you fix the noise issue. And Mass DEP doesn't care. And our police are, I mean, I give our police credit. Our police are not going to go out there and start arresting railroad employees. We'll end up with range wars like they used to have out west with our local cops and those cops. But I got started in this case because some people called me up and said, I can't sleep and I'm breathing in diesel fumes, which are known to be a known carcinogen, which apparently, Mass DOT, again, doesn't care about. Even though under their contract with CSX, they should care about it. But they brought me in. I went before the Board of Selectmen. I've talked to the Board of Health. I called up the EPA, who said during the Trump era, we're not going to enforce it. We don't have any money. Well, now that we're in the Biden era, apparently they just have no interest in enforcing. So, you know, we go from the excuse of, oh, it's Donald Trump. It's Donald Trump. He's cut our funding to, yeah, it's not important. You're poor people. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. It really is a look at, if this was Newton, if this was Cambridge, if this was, I don't know, Quincy, they'd act, they'd do something. But because it's poor little people in Middleborough, or poor little people in Holbrook, or poor little people in places that, you know, that we can't really, we don't know, they don't do anything. And what they're expecting, and we could bring a lawsuit. There's a specific provision that says 10 of us can get together and bring a lawsuit. But we've got to give them 21 days notice, and we've got to let the Attorney General know. I'm sorry, the Attorney General, that's right, Martha Coakley, the people's law firm. Isn't that what she says? She calls it the people's law firm?
Yeah, but I think it's Maura Healey now.
Yeah, Maura Healey, pardon me, not Martha Coakley. Martha Coakley was the first idiot. Martha Coakley was the one who used to do national searches for people and find them in her campaign for positions. That was Martha Coakley. Maura Healey is the one who says, we are the people's law firm, which one is the dumbest thing I've ever heard, since she represents the state against people from the state who want to sue it for things it did wrong. But two, she should be hopping in. It shouldn't be, at this point, there shouldn't have to be a notification to where she knows the issue. It's been sent to her.
Has it been sent to her by your office, or has it been sent to her by the people who are being affected?
By people being affected. And the problem is, you know, you sit there and you listen to her on Browder and Egan wax philosophic about how she helps the people of the state of Massachusetts. Go help some people that actually need helping. I mean, suing the federal government 300 times because you don't like Trump doesn't help the people that are sitting out here that have had noise problems since 2017. I'm sorry, I've devolved into the problem with the system. The problem with the system is people go after sexy things, not necessary things. And the things I'm talking about are the quality of life of, I mean, the one I had on my podcast, think of her. She was a nurse. She's working outrageous hours trying to help people with COVID. And she can't get sleep because some, I don't know, I can think of terrible words to say, but I won't. some ne'er-do-well in state government doesn't care. And she's just working hard to save people like you and me.
But is it, are there not divisions within the Attorney General's office that would handle and work on a specific item like this?
There are that can. Do they? No. At least not for these poor people. Because these poor people look red. They're red. This is a red area. And the problem is, much as all of these wonderful tree-hugging people love to say, we represent those who are red and those who are blue, they don't. That's the hypocrisy of the system. That's the hypocrisy of the parties. And this is what it boils down to. It boils down to the fact that if you're not, if you don't live in the right area that moves the political machine in one direction or another, wait your turn. And it ain't coming.
Is a part of this problem, you mentioned the South Coast Rail, and folks know that this particular venture was something that was reconstituted by one-time Governor Deval Patrick. This was his baby that he was hoping to launch to help try to get, you know, folks from the South Coast up to the Boston area and vice versa, to help kind of with economic development in the New Bedford area. Is it possible, because this thing has been a project that has dragged on, that the state is just digging in its heels saying, we're just going to make this thing happen regardless of any ramifications or who it's affecting?
Look, I guess I could phrase it this way. No one here cares if it happens or not. The state has already let us know in no uncertain terms there will be no economic benefit to us for it coming here. They've said it at meetings. It's not a secret. We tried to work with them to get them to give us some economic benefits that we pointed out that would have been very inexpensive for them in a couple of different ways. As one of our selectmen, Alan Frawley, said, they're coming whether you want them or not. They don't care. They're tin ears. I don't care if they come or if they don't. If they see economic benefit in it to the state, great. Just do it quietly. Do it within the confines of the law. Abide by that law which the pinheads in the legislature passed. And the pinheads in the federal government accepted. Follow law. You expect me to. You expect me to respect. You expect me to respect my neighbors when I have a party. You expect me to keep my music at a reasonable level. You expect me not to let my neighbors go walking out and peeing on somebody else's lawn. That's what you expect from me. That's what I do, because I'm a responsible neighbor. How responsible is the state at the moment? So bringing it back to what you're talking about, we just have a really unruly neighbor. It's called MassDOT. It's called the state of Massachusetts, who won't follow their rules. The problem is the cops I want to call get their paycheck from the guy making the noise. And they don't want to do anything about it.
Is there a chance that can the federal government get involved, or have they been notified and they may also kind of turn a deaf
ear? I had a personal phone call with three different lawyers at the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, which is federal. The first thing I had to do was let them know that I actually understood that our laws, which they said, well, that's state laws and you can't apply that to railroads. I had to let them know that I actually understood that that's untrue, that it was federalized at the EPA. Once we got past the point that I'm not as stupid as they thought I was, it came down to them saying, oh, well, Trump cut our funding, so we don't have the money, so we're not doing that now. Right. Now that Biden's in, right, we're just not doing that now.
Right. So, you stated that earlier in this conversation.
But I want to keep myself constantly.
No, but I want to know, though, is there any agency, any federal agency beyond the EPA that could have any kind of enforcement, or is the EPA it? And if they're negligent, or if they're going to be ignorant to the issue, it sounds to me, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, your only course of action will be to get 10 people together and file a lawsuit.
Correct. And they want that because they want us to expend money, because once we start expending money, we become vulnerable. But they also don't expect anybody to expend the money anyway. The only one I could think of is CDC. because of all the diesel fumes and the fact that it's a diesel fumes are a carcinogen, and they're the federal government has said they're a carcinogen, and it seems to me that that's something that CDC could come in and try and look at. But the Environmental Justice Act, I think, is another way to go, which is, you know, the remember in Brockton, I guess they wanted to put in a power plant.
Yes.
And people brought that up. That, hey, Brockton's a poor area. Let's stick a power plant there. Hey, Brockton's a poor area. Let's stick a sewage treatment plant there. Hey, Brockton's a poor area. Let's stick a big train in there. I mean, that's what Middleborough is becoming. Middleborough is a large area that's undeveloped. It's 70 square miles. It's the second largest landmass town in Massachusetts, and it's farmland. So, you know, people apparently, and it's red. It's predominantly Republican. I think all those things come together to basically say the likelihood of any of the people, some who died of cancer, people who have headaches, people who have breathing problems and all these things right along the tracks, I think all these people are going to go without relief. And right now they're going to go without sleep too. And that's really a crying shame, because there's no party in that. There's no politics that should be in that. This goes to the core function of boards of health and the government, to protect its citizens. Build your railroad. Build it within the confines of the law. Don't exceed the L90, as they say, or go above 85 decibels, or more than 30 over ambient noise levels, or more than 10 over ambient noise levels. Mass DEP, go out there and take the noise readings. Mass EPA, go out there and make sure everybody does what they're supposed to do under the Air Pollution Act. I mean, air pollution is air pollution, and they are sworn to protect the rights of these people.
We have a couple of minutes left in our conversation. I want to kind of just go back half a second. You had mentioned Brock, and I believe in that particular case, it was a private development, not necessarily something that was being done on the state or federal level. And I believe the one thing that was cited was environmental justice.
That's it, the Environmental Justice Act.
Because of what they were doing. So.
Yeah, and whether it's private or not, remember, it's got to get licensed. And power plants go through local, state, and federal licensing. So once you start getting local, state, and federal licensing in there, you now begin to get those local, state, and federal considerations involved. You know, and if there's a problem in terms of the environmental justice, perhaps the feds don't give them, you know, the Federal Energy Commission perhaps doesn't give them a license. You know, remember the casino had to go through some federal maneuvering before you got to the state level maneuvering, before you got to the local level maneuvering. So all of these things are tied up basically at the end of the day, because all of these applications and things create fees for those various entities. So it's like the mafia said, let me get my beak wet. That's all these mafioso families called the state, federal, and local government getting their beaks wet.
As we get ready.
I apologize to the Italians.
Thank you. Appreciate that. as we wrap this up, you got the two different cases going. You got Middleborough, you got Holbrook. Are they both in the same area as far as legally, or is there a difference as to where they are each are in the process?
Holbrook's fascinating, because Holbrook is a group of private citizens that ended up at the end achieving an injunction against the company. And the company is now trying to get its way out from under the court-ordered injunction. So that's a good position to be in. So now they're doing noise monitoring. They're doing all kinds of testing to see whether or not there's a violation of the noise code. In Middleborough, I think the Board of Selectmen are stymied. The Board of Health, there's a woman at the Board of Health who's done some work there, and she's pushing along, but she can't get any. It's like she's putting bait in the water and nobody's pulling the hook. So I think the Middleborough one, because it's a fight with the state as opposed to a private entity, I think that's the harder one. And that's the one that would take, you know, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 to fight. Nobody has that kind of money. They're poor people.
Right. But I think cases have shown that if you wait it out. And again, money is the key factor in some of these instances. If you can wait out the process, sometimes you can be victorious, correct?
Yes, and under the statute, though, if you get the injunction against the agency and you lose, you have to pay their attorney's fees. So you think anybody wants to do that? I wouldn't lose, but, you know, God help us.
He is Adam Bond, attorney at law. He is on this program on a regular basis, almost like he's we should do a regular segment, not called Legal Grounds, of course, but we should do a regular segment where you're on talking about legal issues.
Now that I'm 57, regularity is very important to me. So, yes, I'd like to.
All right. Well, God bless you and your bowel movements. And until next time.
I take it that's all going to be edited out.
No. This is live, baby. All right. So we are going to step aside. Before we step in it, speaking with Adam Bond. We'll be back in just a moment. You are tuned in to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD.
I'm Peter Brown of Tiny & Sons Auto Glass in Pembroke. People ask me, is there anything they can do to prevent getting a broken windshield?
Is there anything I can do to prevent getting a broken windshield?
See? There is. Those big gravel trucks, when they're being loaded, rocks get stuck in the framework of the bed. Truck hits a bump, rock hits your windshield. It pays to stay way back.
It pays to stay way back.
However, if your windshield is broken, just call 1-888-64-TINIES. And thank you.
Plymouth 400 Inc. continues their mission of education and commemoration of the 400th anniversary of Plymouth's founding with a new television series called Plymouth 400 Conversations. The program will focus on authors, filmmakers, artists, and poets who discuss how the 400th anniversary commemoration influenced their work. Each episode premieres Thursday nights at 7:30 on PAC-TV, but available online for everyone to see the following day. Despite the pandemic, the 400th anniversary commemoration continues into 2021 with great virtual programming now, including this fascinating new virtual series, and live events later in the year. See what Plymouth 400 Inc. has scheduled. Shop for Plymouth 400 anniversary merchandise to share with friends and family, and catch the most recent episode of Plymouth 400 Conversations. Visit Plymouth400Inc.org.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. Don't just listen, say something. Call 781-837-4900. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
Joining us is true crime author Maureen Boyle. And Maureen has written yet another book. She's here to talk with us about The Ghost. Welcome to the program, Maureen.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here. So good to see you, even if it's via Zoom here. I just really enjoy being on your programs.
I have to say, first and foremost, folks, just a little backstory so folks know. I was privileged back many years ago to be able to work with Maureen, who is an award-winning journalist, somebody who is teaching the craft to the next generation of journalists, but she's also one heck of a writer. And we're going to talk a little bit about this new book. Now, if you remember, it was a while ago. We actually talked to her about Shallow Graves. Remember, that was her first book. That was about the serial killings in New Bedford. This new one is called The Ghost, The Murder of Police Chief Greg Adams and the Hunt for His Killer. If you will, kind of give us just a little bit of the story about who Greg Adams is.
Yeah, Greg Adams was a police chief in the small town of Saxonburg, Pennsylvania. Saxonburg, to give you an idea, is smaller than Rochester, Massachusetts, smaller than Kingston. Very, very tiny community. It is been described to me as Mayberry. That's the type of town it is, where everyone knows everyone. People walk through the downtown and saying hi to each other. Very, very friendly community. In 1980, Greg Adams was the police chief in Saxonburg. The police department consisted of two full-time police officers. In that part of the state, for many of the crimes, state police investigated them, a little bit different than what we have here. A couple of weeks before Christmas, in December of 1980, the chief pulled over a vehicle about two blocks away from the police station, and he pulled it over into a parking lot of an Agway. And the next thing anyone knows is someone heard a sound that sounded like someone hitting something on a tree. And then they heard a young boy who was homesick from school, heard a voice saying, "Help me, help me, help me." He and his mother went outside and found the chief bloody and dying. He later died at the police at the local hospital, and the killer just seemed to have vanished. Someone saw the vehicle leave. Law enforcement throughout the area just circled the town. Remember, this is a rural town, so you have to know your way around to be able to get out of there. Remember, back in 1980, we didn't have GPS, didn't have, you know, cell phones with everything on it. And the killer seemed to have disappeared. And eventually they were able to obtain a name of a suspect. And that suspect was an individual by the name of Donald Webb, who was living in New Bedford, Massachusetts. That's how I learned about the case, shortly after Shallow Graves was published. And this was as the case was, the case of the police chief's murder was finally resolved. And I got interested in the case because of just the idea of secrets. And it's something that really struck home to me from when I was working on Shallow Graves. How could someone keep a secret of who the killer was? Because I'm still convinced that someone knows who the killer is in the New Bedford Highway serial killings, and someone's holding very, very tight to that secret. And I thought, back then, oh, no one could keep a secret that long. This is an abnormality. And then this case came along, and it again brought up the idea of secrets. How could this killer elude authorities for so long and in such a interesting way? So that's how I first got involved with it. I went down to Saxonburg twice for about a week at each time, talking to people down there, interviewed about 70 people for this book, and found it very, very riveting. It is a case of what happens when law enforcement ultimately all work together. Because this is a case that was ultimately solved by the cooperation of state police in two states and FBI in out of the Boston office. It was a case where there were no egos at the end. It really highlights the best in law enforcement, and I think perhaps the worst in human nature, because the killer was allowed to be free for so many years. So that whole concept of secrets really just kept me going through the whole process of researching and writing this. How could someone keep secrets for so long?
If you would do a compare and contrast of writing Shallow Graves and knowing that you had so much information that you yourself personally compiled and that you reported on, to where you're coming into this where your interest is piqued by the story, and it's almost like you're starting fresh, and you're talking about this is something that happened in 1980, so we're talking decades ago. What was the research like?
That's a really good question. And it was very different because not only was I going back in time, I was also going to a state that I wasn't all that familiar with. And with a book like this, you have to get the streets right. You have to know the difference between townships and boroughs. And, you know, the whole system in Pennsylvania is very different than what might be up here. You have to know what highway is going through what community and remember it. And know the proper terms for the type of governments in that area. You know, here I could just rattle off the information because it's just so ingrained. So it made me have to work a little bit harder in that way. And that was good. And because I didn't know anything really that much about the case going into it, it was all very fresh. So I was able to ask, I think, even more questions because I couldn't make any assumptions because I was looking for answers.
Did you feel that the individuals were welcoming to you? Here you are. You're an outsider. You're from another state. And here you are asking these questions. Did you feel that people were forthcoming and willing to talk to you? Or did you meet any resistance along the way?
You know, that's an interesting question. And I was really blessed that those in Saxonburg just welcomed us with open arms. They were so cooperative, so helpful. I had spoken to a number of the subjects in the book at least twice before going down to Saxonburg, and then had more extensive interviews with them both times that we went down there. And people were just terrific, awesome. It's just such a warm and tight-knit community, and there was no, oh, what do you want to know? They're like, oh, thank you for remembering Greg Adams. Thank you for doing this.
But it seems as though, and I was going, that was my next question was, is that if people were so welcoming, it sounds as though they want to resolve this crime and find answers for his murder.
Yes, yes. And also they don't want people to forget the Chief Adams. And every year they hold a memorial for him. Every single year. There's a street named after him. They have a memorial in front of their municipal building. He's not forgotten there. It really is, you know, a scar in the heart of that community.
Again, if you're just tuning in, we are speaking with Maureen Boyle. And we're here talking about the ghost, the murder of Police Chief Greg Adams and the hunt for his killer. And the question asked is, how could such a dark secret have been kept for so many years? You might want to check this book out. How was your approach to writing this book any different? Did you keep the same approach to writing Shiloh Graves as you did The Ghost? Or did you have to tweak or refine anything?
I kept some of the approach very similar. I have a tendency to write as I report, especially some of the scenes, while it's still fresh in my mind, and then fine-tune it as I go along. So part of that was that process was very, very similar.
So when you were writing the book, so did you feel like the information was flowing, or did you have any times? It's almost when you're writing, sometimes you have writer's block, or sometimes you'll get so much information going, all right, something doesn't fit here, I'm missing another puzzle piece. Did you come across any types of challenges like that?
Yes. There were different spots where it's like, oh, this isn't working. And the reason why it wasn't working is that I had to get more information. I needed to talk to more people. I was trying to write around a hole. So, and you can't do that. That's a signal that you have more work that's got to be done.
Now are you the first person who's actually written a book about Chief Adams, or have there been others who've made an attempt to do this? Not successful, as I seems to be, you might have been.
As far as I know, that there has not been any other book written about Chief Adams and his and the killer's ties to Massachusetts. And the killer's ties were very, very deep here in Massachusetts.
Now, is it worth asking, did you find any local scribe down there or maybe someone, a Maureen Boyle-esque person who might have been, that maybe you could have connected with, go, hey, what's some of the things to help you in your research process?
Actually not. I did, you know, I was in contact with the reporters, a couple of the reporters down there. And I'll tell you, the community reporting down there is absolutely wonderful. It is alive and well. They have a very, very strong and vibrant daily newspaper in the Saxonburg area called the Butler Eagle. It is community journalism where everything is covered. But they have a job to do and they're working, churning out stories every day. But they were very welcoming and very, very nice. But no, they were not helping with the research. I did rely on some of the old stories of the primarily that were in the Butler Eagle from scrapbooks that some of the police officers had, and as well as the Saxonburg Museum.
Now, again, we have you and I prior to sitting down and talking. One of the key things we want to make sure of is that we want folks to sit down and to read this book and find out what actually happened. But I think the one thing that I wanted to probably ask is, did you find that the police department, you know, there's a lot of technology that has been introduced since 1980 in the ways of tracking down, whether it's DNA or there are different ways to be able to help move along a cold case. Did you find that any of that was introduced prior to your coming on board, or maybe your introduction helped move that?
No, actually, they knew early on who the killer was. It was a matter of finding him. This entire case was really solved early on, but although they didn't have the killer in custody, just through good old police work, cops hitting the street, knocking on doors, interviewing people, talking to each other, cooperating. And what was interesting, I found out early on in this was, you know, there's always this story that local police and state police don't get along with the FBI. You know, that, oh, the feds, they don't play well with others. But through this case, right from the very start, the state police in Pennsylvania and the FBI resident agents there worked very, very closely, and they knew each other. You know, they were neighbors. They were friends. So they worked very tightly together. And the FBI agents in Pennsylvania also knew one of the agents that was up here, a man named George Bates, because they worked together elsewhere. And George Bates was very close with the state police. They were very friendly at that time. So they all were working very closely together from the very start, the state police and the FBI. And at the conclusion of the case, it was solved again with state police and the FBI, state police in two states.
I would ask you this, and again, asking you to put your journalist hat on. I mean, you worked for many years as a reporter, and you've seen a lot of, you know, if you're looking at how you've had to deal with police departments, and as you talked about, you know, where there's a jurisdiction and it's like, hey, this is my, you know, this is my jurisdiction, not yours. Looking at, and again, this is not to say, hey, in, you know, my hometown or the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. But I want to hear that. I want to hear about that, knowing that you got to see how friendly and how much they respected each other. Do you feel that in your prior book when you were writing Shallow Graves that it was similar, that you had police cooperation and that there were different agencies were working well in concert with each other, or not so much?
In the first case with in Shallow Graves with the New Bedford Highway serial killing, I really think that case could have been expanded if the Plymouth County District Attorney's Office was allowed a more active role with and combined forces with the Bristol County District Attorney's Office, because they really did need more manpower. So that's where that became a, no, this is our case versus, and it wasn't on the state police end, I'll make that clear. But it was, I mean, I remember when there was, when the bodies was found in Marion, which is in Plymouth County, in the highway killing case, and someone from the DA's office had said, this is our body. And it's like, you know, it just felt wrong. It's like, it's not your body, that's, you know, the victim, you know, and you should be working together.
What is it like, and you know, for folks who've never been in the trenches or who've never had to write stories when some kind of tragedy happens, you know, as a veteran writer, you learn how to empathize with family members and be able to talk with them. What was it like the first time you met some of Chief Adams' family members and were talking to them and hearing and seeing their emotions as they were talking about that night and giving you some of the information to help write the book?
Well, for Chief Adams's family, they're scattered all over. So I interviewed them all by phone. And his widow, who has since remarried, it was very, very emotional interviews. I interviewed her about four times. And it was very, very emotional, as you could see as she recounted what happened when she found out about her husband's death. It was a very difficult time for her. And, you know, you could really hear the pain in her voice even decades later, because here she was a widow with two small children.
Right. You had two sons, if I'm correct, right?
Two sons. One was an infant and one was a toddler. So they were very, very young.
What was, did you have a chance to talk with them? And what were you able to glean from talking to them about this book?
The youngest son was, you know, too young to remember anything. The oldest son, he described his father as it was, and he said this many times, that his father was almost like a phantom, because he never really knew him. It was, he remembers images and feelings and his presence, but he was way too young, and he missed out on knowing his father.
So I had a chance to kind of take a look at some of the reviews on Amazon, and you received some glowing reviews from some of your peers. One individual who is a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter called your book, I believe your book was called Gripping. Okay. Actually, that was a former host of Extra, actually called it Gripping.
Jerry Pinacoli.
Yeah, yeah. You've got Michelle McPhee, who has written some books. Hank Philippi Ryan, who is, I know some of you, this, you mutual admiration. What's it like to have your peers not only pick up your book and read it, but also share their thoughts and give you kudos? What's that like?
It's very, very humbling. It really is, because, you know, these are people who I respect, who are just, you know, wonderful writers, wonderful reporters. You know, Hank Philippi Ryan is an amazing woman. She is one of the hardest working people in the business. And her books are just so much fun and just so intriguing. I can't say enough about her work. And Michelle McPhee, when she gets into a story, she just doesn't let go. You know, as her two of her books on the Boston Marathon bombings highlight, and she's still pursuing that. You know, To use an old cliche, it's like a dog with a bone. She's not going to let go until she has the answers that she wants. So she's inspiring.
But no, and knowing that she, you know, she wrote for a local paper, a Boston paper. I mean, she's saying you're everything a true crime writer should be: tenacious, unrelenting. How do you stay humble with all those great compliments?
Oh, it's real easy in my household to stay humble. it's just very nice to hear those wonderful things, and I really appreciate people saying that. It's nice.
Well, my understanding is that you finally got copies. You finally just got copies of your new book. Is it any different holding the new book, The Ghost, than it was when you birthed your first baby, Shallow Graves? Any different feeling, or is you still get a glow about it?
I still get a glow. I still think it's, you know, really, really neat. I never, when you're growing up, you think, and you're a writer, oh, I'm going to write the great American novel. Well, I never thought I'd write the great American novel, but, you know, someday you're going to write a book, you're going to write short stories. I never thought I would write poetry because I'm a very bad poet, but it would be, that was always a dream, but I always thought that would be completely unattainable. You have to be in a certain class to be able to write books. You have to, be going to Ivy League schools. You have to know someone to do this. And it was, with the first book, it was, the first book was a labor of love. It really was. And I was just so glad that it was out and well-received. And my hope with the first book was always, maybe the killer will be found. And I think he still will be in the New Bedford Highway killing case. In this case, it was a little bit different. I just wanted people to know who Greg Adams was, who the killer was, and all the work that went into this. And so, sort of look behind the curtain to see what really goes into these cases. Because very often, and you see it a lot with social media, we have the keyboard warriors always criticizing investigators. No, they're not doing anything. We don't hear anything about it. Well, you don't hear anything about it because you're not supposed to hear anything about it. When things are under investigation, guess what? They're secret. They're looking at suspects. No, they don't release names. If they're, searching in a different area or trying to track someone down, they don't broadcast it out there. There's a lot of work behind the scenes that goes out. And I hope this book allows people to see what goes on behind the scenes when they thought nothing was going on.
I will say you did a fantastic job in promoting and getting around and doing the library tours for Shallow Graves, knowing that this gloom called COVID is lifting. Are you planning a similar promotion of The Ghost? And where can folks be able to follow you if they want to see if you're coming to a library near them or if you're going to be doing book signings?
Yes. I have a website, maureenboylewriter.com. You can still also find information about Shallow Graves on shallowgravesabook.com. I'm on Twitter, on Instagram, and there is a Facebook page for the book, which is The Ghost, The Murder of Greg Adams and the Hunt for His Killer. It may be a shortened version, whatever fits on there for a Facebook page, but it's so they can find out, especially on Facebook. There's a lot of information on there. And I also have an author's page on Facebook of Maureen Boyle.
Maureen, anything as we wrap this conversation up, I usually try to give my guests an opportunity because I can't ask every question and maybe I might overlook a particular question. But is there an essential question that I should have asked you or that you're asked that you feel is kind of important to folks who are interested in buying this book and reading this book?
Well, first, one question I didn't answer to you, where they could buy the book. Barnes & Noble, I know in Dartmouth and in Rhode Island it's available. It's probably available also in Hingham and also on Amazon. And just inquire at your local bookstores about it, and they can order it for you.
We have been speaking with Maureen Boyle, award-winning journalist, but she's also a book author. You want to check her out, true crimes author. Maureen, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much. I always appreciate being on your show.
And that's all the program that we have here, folks. Thank you again for tuning in. Until next week at 6:15 p.m., have yourself a great night.